artificial intelligence not only sort of groups together all these disparate technologies, but the word intelligence suggests something that's not there. And the very notion of intelligence is hugely problematic, right? If we also dig into the eugenicist and racist history of that concept applied to people. But when you talk about a system as AI or artificial intelligence, you're suggesting that there is a reasoning entity inside of there that furthermore maybe could be accountable for the decisions that it's making or could explain the decisions that it's making. And that makes it very hard for us as decision makers, as users, as people who are being subjected to these systems, to reason about what's going on.
Welcome to Politics, a show where two software developers break the fourth wall and talk about the interlacing of technology and politics. I'm Josh.
And I'm Ray. We see technologies like crypto, AI, and surveillance infecting our politics. Meanwhile, governments and the media are making out that all this is inevitable. We can't leave the future in the hands of scheming technology leaders and their pet politicians.
We're here to raise our voice and open up the space for honest, good faith discussions. To help us organize and sharpen our ideas, we've invited some interesting and highly respected thinkers to share their understanding and their research with us and, of course, with you.
Politics is where we smash the myths and get to the truth.
Ray, we need to talk about rhetorical technology.
I think you'll have to answer that question yourself, Josh.
Well, it was a rhetorical question, Ray, but actually I can do better than that.
Oh,
so okay. I reached out to Dr. Emily Bender, and she was kind enough to agree to come on the show and tell us all about rhetorical technology and other stuff. So with that, I would like to welcome you on the show, Dr. Bender.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us. And could you let folks know who you are?
Sure. My name is Emily M. Bender. I'm a professor of linguistics, not rhetoric, but, you know, I'm close enough. At the University of Washington, I co-host a podcast called Mystery AI Hype Theater 3000, and also recently published a book together with my co-host on that podcast, Dr. Alex Hanna, called The AI Con, How to Fight Big Tech's Hype and Create the Future We Want.
An excellent book.
Thank you.
And everybody should, of course, in addition to checking out the book, they should listen to the podcast. It is really great.
We have fun.
Yeah, it's cold. Yeah.
Yes, as do your listeners, I can assure you. So you work in the field of computational linguistics, is that right?
Yep.
Can you explain what that is? Because I know both of those words separately, but I'm not sure I know what they mean together.
So I have been working in this field, depending on how you count, since about 1996, and I've been teaching in this field since 2003, and I used to answer the question, what is computational linguistics, by pointing to the movie 2001: A Space Odyssey, and in particular, the machine called HAL, and saying everything you would need to do to go from the person speaking to the internal representation in HAL, and then there's some non-computational linguistic stuff that happens on the inside of HAL, and then you get more compling on the way back out. And then a few years after that, I could say, you know, Siri on the iPhone? Everything you have to do to build Siri, that's computational linguistics. And now I say, you know, ChatGPT, I'm sorry. But the more sort of serious answer is that linguistics is the study of how language works and how we work with language. And computational linguistics is getting computers to deal with our language, either for practical applications, which is most of what you're going to encounter, or also for linguistic research. Like if you can do, just like there's computational biology and so on, you can do a research-oriented computational linguistics as well.
Okay.
Great. Okay, so we're going to be talking about AI today. Mm-hmm. So how do you define AI?
So it's a marketing term.
Sure.
And it doesn't refer to a coherent set of technologies. It basically pulls in these tropes from science fiction and allows people selling the technology to say this is much more, they would say capable, I would say functional, than it actually is. And it's a term that I do my very best to avoid, despite it being in the title of my book. And we had long fights about scare quotes Alex and I, at one point she said, all right, Emily, you can have the modifier so-called, or you can have scare quotes, but you can't have them both at the same time. And I've also just finished writing an encyclopedia entry for the Oxford Research Encyclopedia on Science, Technology, and Society for the heading Artificial Intelligence. And when they invited me, I was like, you realize what I'm going to do with this, right? And they're like, yeah, that's why we asked you. And it's organized around a series of statements that start with things like AI is a research field, AI is an approach to cognitive science, but then goes into things like AI is a way to devalue and hide human labor, AI is an ideology, AI is a way to centralize power, and a couple others like that.
Well, I think those are very useful ways to categorize the thing, because that's one of the things about our season, I think, is that we, or about our series, is that we want to at least clarify what AI is in general, because
it's been a struggle, actually, to figure that out. It's been a struggle.
Yeah. And I think it's, again, it's like maybe, it's, you know, linguistic point is that it's a very effective marketing term, because it's very baggy and loose and allows all kinds of bending of the various fields of AI to be brought into service of this one hyperscaled AI. Mm-hmm. Is that something that resonates with you as well in terms of your feeling about this term?
Yeah. So sometimes when you're trying to argue with someone about their use of so-called artificial intelligence, and I come at it just very anti. It's like, you know,
sure,
I am not going to give the benefit of the doubt at all. People will say, but AI is helping radiologists detect breast cancer easier or something. It's like, okay, but that's got nothing to do with ChatGPT. It's separate technology. Yeah. And so anytime someone who's doing something sensible with machine learning or, you know, implemented statistical pattern matching, where the input-output relationship makes sense, they've got good training data, it's been evaluated well, and the tech really fits into its use case, when they call that artificial intelligence, they're basically lending credence to the ridiculous claims that people like Sam Altman are making.
Yeah, I think that's one of our biggest concerns about determining whether AI is good or not. Because like you say, there are certain aspects of it, AlphaFold even, where you would say, actually, there's some science behind that that makes good use of specific technology. It's not going to burn the planet up. It does a specific job and gives a very interesting result. But calling it AI, we need new words, you know. So what is it? What are the new words we need? Anyway, we'll come up to these new words a bit later, maybe.
Yeah. I have some ideas, especially around the language technology ones.
Excellent. So you mentioned the AI Con already, and like I said, it is a very good book, quite entertaining as well. And there's a fun bit at the beginning on the use of scare quotes where you talk about when we say AI and scare quotes, this is what we mean and so on. But aside from wanting to have fun with a friend, you know, what was the reason you two decided to write this book? What were you trying to accomplish?
Yeah, so the book grows out of our podcast, and the podcast has a similar sense of humor, but it's reactive. So for each episode, we take when we do our All Hell episodes, it's like 30 artifacts. And those artifacts tend to be hype artifacts where people are saying ridiculous things about what they're calling artificial intelligence. And we sort of puncture the hype and we do what Alex calls ridicule as praxis. And we had, you know, people referring to our podcast, like it was showing up in reading lists in various policy circles, which is super exciting, but it's not very compact. Right. The idea is that we sort of get to dig in and have fun. And it's also very, very loose in the sense of it starts off life as a live stream. So it's not super scripted or it is what it is. And so we sort of realized after maybe a few dozen episodes of the podcast that there was a core argument that we were making and that it would be helpful to have that argument in a more portable package where somebody didn't have to sort of wait for a topic to come around they were interested in or put it together across the different episodes, but also to more affirmatively state the case for, you know, what we were arguing for. And then we had the good fortune of being approached by some literary agents who asked if we maybe wanted to write a book. And that was like, okay, I guess it's time. someone's asking us.
So You were, of course, one of the authors of the Stochastic Parrots paper, which is actually called, I had to write this down, On the Dangers of Stochastic Parrots, Can Language Models Be Too Big?
Parrot emoji. The parrot emoji is part of the title.
Oh, right. Okay. I did not write that down, but good, good reminder. I just reread that last year, and it made me very sad because you kind of laid out, you were like, here are the dangerous things. We need to not do these things. And then it's like, well, they just did all of the things that you said not to do with the consequences that that paper predicted. It's great reading in one way because it's, you know, a very well-reasoned argument, but it's extremely depressing. So the point here, though, is to not wallow in darkness, but I have heard you say somewhere, and I can't remember where, that you felt like you wanted to move away from the phrase stochastic parrot. You thought other phrasing might be better.
Yeah. I wouldn't say that I'm moving away from it so much as I've made multiple attempts to make vivid what it is that these systems do. And stochastic parrots is one such phrase. Maybe the biggest downside of that phrase is that it suggests something that I don't want to commit to about actual parrots. Mm-hmm. And so I tell people that I'm leaning on the English verb to parrot, which means to repeat back without understanding.
Right.
No mm-hmm. relation to the actual animals, despite putting the cute parrot emoji in the title of the paper. But, you know, I have made other attempts, and one of them is synthetic text extruding machines, which I quite like because, first of all, it names what's coming out for what it is. Right. Yes. It's not language use. It's not conversation, but it is synthetic text. And then the verb extrude is a little bit gross, which feels appropriate.
It is. Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't quite understand what stochastic is either.
Yeah.
So maybe it's a bit more approachable to say that it's, you know, extruding.
Yeah. And we'll get people saying things like, well, what do you mean it's a stochastic parrot? It's saying something new that wasn't in the training data. It's like, yeah, that's the stochastic bit, right? It's repeatedly answering the question, what's the likely next word? And if you do that, you're not going to necessarily get things that were directly in the training data. And that's okay. That's stochastic. It's still not understanding.
I mean, it kind of is in the training data. It's just the ordering might be different from...
Well, so...
Because it's not learning anything new, is it? It's not actually taking anything out of the world and, you know, producing something genuinely novel, only a rearrangement of what it has been given.
Right. And what it's been given is just word forms. So when we look at the training data, if we're looking at portions of the training data that are in a language that we speak and read, we see ideas and meaning and discussions and arguments. But all the system has is actually bits of spellings of words and what orders they go in.
And their kind of statistical likelihood in given domains.
Yeah, exactly. What is likely to go where? And it's not even which word, but which bits of words are likely to go where.
Yeah, I really like the synthetic text extruding machines. I was on a run last summer or something listening to an episode of your podcast, which was the first time I had ever heard that term used. And I liked it a lot. And as I was running along, I was trying to think of a better way to say hallucinate, because I really don't like this anthropomorphic language used about LLMs. So like, I ran this by Ray, and I'm afraid it didn't fly, did it, Ray? What did I say? Extruding counterfactual text or non-factual text or something. I don't know. I just couldn't find
one. He's not as good at this kind of shit as you are, I'm afraid, am I?
Do you have a good word for it?
So I can certainly help you problematize hallucinate. You're absolutely right that it's anthropomorphizing, right? Because to hallucinate is to perceive something that isn't there. And these machines aren't perceiving anything.
Right.
Mm. What they're doing is they're outputting synthetic text that doesn't correspond to how we understand the world. Like when we read it and evaluate it, it doesn't evaluate as true. The other problem I have with hallucinate is that it suggests that some of the time the machines are doing something that is not that, right? That there's some kind of an inherent difference between the text that comes out that we evaluate as true and the text that comes out that we don't. When in fact, in both cases, it's just synthetic text extruded according to the probabilities. And so I don't think I have a one-to-one replacement for hallucination, but instead I like to talk about how the output of the system is just the synthetic text. And furthermore, it's text that nobody has any accountability for.
Right. Yeah, I think the thing that we try to focus on a little bit, because we're programmers, so the thing that we try to focus on explaining to other programmers, which is kind of weird that we have to explain this, is that the machine's output is non-deterministic.
Yeah.
And that is bad. That is really bad. If you want to say whether it's a good output or a bad output, whether it's a good system or a bad system, usually you want these things to be given a certain input to reasonably deterministically produce a certain output. But that's completely impossible with these machines. I don't know if that is something that is something which you've considered, you know, this like non-deterministic aspect of the machines.
Yeah, I mean, it comes up a lot when people, and it's not just large language models. It's not just the synthetic media machines that are non-deterministic. That's a property of machine learning in general, right? Right. So there's certain kinds of programming where, like, you create a calculator, you want it to always give the same output for the same input, and you want that output to be following the rules of arithmetic. And if you run into a floating point error, it's really embarrassing, right? So that is sort of a lot of how we think about computers. Machine learning as a set of approaches to computation is, I think, specifically designed for cases where we either don't know what the rules are, so we can't write something fully deterministic, or it's a situation where those rules are just going to be impossible to do. So if you think about the problem of going from an audio signal to a transcript in the same language, so spoken language to written language, there's no rule-based way of doing that.
Hmm.
To give you another example, I got to work as a grammar engineer in between grad school and my academic positions, building a grammar for Japanese at this now defunct startup in Silicon Valley. And part of my job in, this is like 2001, 2002, was to hand weight the grammar rules so that, because there's always ambiguity in natural language, when the grammar found multiple parses, the right one would be on top. That's a fool's errand. There is no way to sort of logic your way to what is the right weight for this rule because all the rules interact. But we can do really good parse selection using statistical modeling by building up a machine learning model of which rules are likely to combine in which ways given which words is the input string. It's not a perfectly solved problem, but that's a case where something non-deterministic actually is our best bet. The problem is when you come back around to synthetic text, and especially the way it's being presented to the world, is like, here's an everything machine that can answer all of your questions. And there's lots of problems even with that framing to start with. But if you're going to ask it questions like, you know, what time does the post office close? There's an answer to that. There's a perfectly good rule-based way to set up a system that can answer those questions.
Yeah.
And we're not doing it.
Yeah, I think, and this is another point that I've heard you make. I think you mentioned it in the book as well, where you make the point that we should think about AI as automation technology.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the interesting questions then you can ask are, what is being automated, by whom, and like, basically, how is it affecting the people whose work is being automated? Why do you think it's so important to talk about this stuff as automation rather than artificial intelligence?
It comes back around to this demystification that we're trying to do. So artificial intelligence not only sort of groups together all these disparate technologies, but the word intelligence suggests something that's not there. And the very notion of intelligence is hugely problematic, right? If we also dig into the eugenicist and racist history of that concept applied to people. But when you talk about a system as AI or artificial intelligence, you're suggesting that there is a reasoning entity inside of there that furthermore maybe could be accountable for the decisions that it's making or could explain the decisions that it's making. And that makes it very hard for us as decision makers, as users, as people who are being subjected to these systems to reason about what's going on. But if we talk instead in terms of automation, we can basically set it up as what are we automating? Why are we automating it? What's going to happen if we automate that? Even if it works perfectly well, how does that change the situation that it's in? Also, is this even a reasonable thing to automate? So one of our go-to examples is repeatedly in the research literature, you see people suggesting that they can make systems that predict whether or not a person is a criminal based on a picture of their face.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And right, that just that input-output pair makes no sense at all, because the status of being a criminal is a combination of, well, what counts as crime in your society? How are things policed? What actions did you take? What actions did people around you take? And none of that is written on your face.
unless you are a race scientist, right? And there is a problematic linkage between, well, not problematic. I don't know why I said that. There's a fucked up linkage between this technology and like straight up eugenics and race science, right? That doesn't seem to be an accident.
No. And it's, you can find it if you go into the places where people are trying to define artificial general intelligence and like even just open like the first citation where they're defining what intelligence is, you land on race science.
Yeah.
We've seen that multiple times. So in the modern day, that's true. And also in the history of all this, it's true. And I want to put a plug in here for this new documentary out called Ghost in the Machine.
Right.
That Valerie Veach put together that digs very compellingly into that history. And it's a well-done film. So if people want to know more about the historical connection, a couple other good resources there are Timnit Gebru and Emil Torres's paper on the Tescreel bundle of ideologies.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Adam Becker's book, More Everything Forever, that also digs into the same sort of ideology and its historical antecedents and racist present.
I think Joy Buluwemi as well is another great resource for this kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Her book, Unmasking AI, is fantastic.
Yeah.
And also the her organization called the Algorithmic Justice League is
yes.
a wonderful, wonderful place to start getting involved with things.
I mean, her videos explaining why the machines don't recognize Black people or Black women especially is very, very revealing. Yeah. Okay, right, moving on. The other thing we want to speak to you a little bit about or get your kind of like a hot takes on maybe is some other framings around AI that are like being pushed, especially by the sort of leaders of the industry. But I feel like it's not even the leaders of the industry now. Maybe it's being absorbed but more sort of by middle managers and even by users of the technology. And the first one I want to ask you about is the inevitability hype.
Yeah.
You know, this notion that everyone is basically saying, oh, look, it's out there. It's coming. It's inevitable. It's here. It's not going anywhere. Deal with it. How do you feel about that one?
Yeah. Frustrated. So I have to say.
Okay. Oh, that's a relief because we're definitely feeling that way too.
But, you know, anytime someone makes these arguments from inevitability, I think it's important to recognize them as an attempt to steal agency. Because the future's not written, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's true that we don't uninvent things, but what actually has been invented here? There's not thinking machines. There's not these machine gods. What there is are things like the transformer architecture, which is a way to better model the distribution of word forms in text than what we had previously.
Yeah.
And sure, that's not going away. You know, it would take a long time for that particular knowledge to get lost. I mean, you could imagine scenarios where we lost lots of scientific knowledge and that would be among it. But that doesn't mean that the current situation where we have companies like Anthropic, OpenAI, Google, putting enormous amounts of resources into creating these systems that then people can walk up to and grab synthetic text out of, and that people are being told they have to incorporate into all of their workflows, those systems rest on a very large concentration of capital, a relatively low willingness to tax that capital, a contested willingness to build the large data centers, a contested willingness to allow the data theft, and so on. All of that is precarious. And I see no reason to believe that we have to just sit back and assume that not only is it always going to be here, but we have to rework education, medicine, law, everything to accommodate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the other thing that is coming out from it's kind of hilarious in some ways. There was a discussion when Anthropic and OpenAI there was a debate about whether Anthropic was the good guy in the military contracting thing versus OpenAI. And, you know, obviously, maybe you can explain why that is nonsense in a bit more detail. But the assertion by these people often is that AI safety is our greatest concern.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that assertion?
It is a misdirection, and it's also part of the hype. So AI safety is the name for protecting people from, in quotes, AI systems. And it's not, you know, protecting people who are arrested after a false match in a facial recognition system. It's not protecting people who are working under horrible conditions, cleaning up the outputs of these systems with, you know, no mental health supports for $2 an hour. It's not about protecting the residents of Boxtown in near Nashville, who are breathing in all the pollutants off of the methane generators that Elon Musk is using to power his data center, right? These are real safety issues. It's not about protecting the people who are told that, hey, ChatGPT has a health app now. I'm going to get my health information from this, and then they're harmed, right? No, the AI safety is about this idea that at some point, the racist pile of linear algebra is going to get big enough that it combusts into consciousness, and it's going to decide it doesn't need people anymore, and it's going to kill us all. And there is a sort of a relatively frequent question of, well, why don't you people who are concerned with what sometimes are called AI ethics or critical AI, why don't you make common cause with these AI safety people? Because you both want less of this, right? And the problem is that the AI safety people are grabbing attention, grabbing enormous amounts of funding. They've managed to enlist a few of the billionaires onto their cause. And you know, the billionaire shouldn't have that money. It should be taxed, and then we could redistribute it differently. But they've also enlisted politicians. So Bernie Sanders is talking to the AI safety people now, which is, and like producing these things that look like Anthropic ads. It's terrible. And we've even heard about this like training for AI safety people where they're being taught how to pretend to care about the actual harms so as to get more people on board, when they're really, their core concern is this fantasy of artificial superintelligence. So that's one big problem. And the other problem is that it is just more marketing, right? So if you have a system that's so powerful, it might kill us all, well, then you have a powerful system. And wouldn't your customers want a piece of that?
That's so interesting about the AI safety training. I had not heard about that, but that, so something weird happened to a friend of mine, like about 2 months ago. So they had this, you know, AI, whatever, expert come in from outside and tell them about AI in their workplace, something, something. And it was set up very much as a, like, let's talk about AI. And the whole beginning of it, the actual expert was talking to them about, hey, so we know that AI is bad for the environment. We know this, we know that, blah, blah, blah. This is terrible. And then there was like a short break. And the second part of this was, okay, so how are we going to use AI to do all our work? And like my friend was just like, what the hell is going on here? Like, why would this person say all of this stuff and then just move to that? But I guess perhaps that's what's going on there.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't sound like an AI safety person so much as somebody who has been trained to like try to defang the concerns by saying, yes, we know it's bad for the environment. And if you if they've said it in their own voice with maybe a less compelling version of it, then it's harder for someone in the second half to say, well, wait a minute, what about the environmental impacts? What about the labor implications and so on?
Okay, that makes sense.
Speaking of rhetorical technology.
Indeed.
Yeah, so the final kind of like framing thing that I think is interesting, at least I'd like to get your thoughts on, which probably are interesting, is that the AI we have now will lead us to a higher level of AI, so-called artificial general intelligence, or more recently, artificial superintelligence. And it will be able to finally solve problems like climate change. Now, we kind of already know what the answer is to climate change, but apparently that's not a good answer. So these things are going to answer all other things about like basically human happiness and solve all medical issues, etc. Do you think this is going to happen?
No, of course not. Okay. Right? And this is predicated on a real misunderstanding of, first of all, how science happens, and secondly, sort of what the nature of the problems are. Because you're right, the issue with climate, the climate crisis, isn't a lack of technology, it's a lack of political will, right? And a capture of the sort of policymaking space by the people who would prefer to just make lots and lots of money off of fossil fuels for now while they're alive, right? That's the, we know the answer, stop burning fossil fuels. Right?
So it's not carbon capture, it's regulatory capture is the, okay.
Yeah.
Ooh, I got you. Nice move.
You got it, yeah. So there's that problem. But also the picture of science here, and here the work of Lisa Masseri and MJ Crockett on sort of the way the ideology of artificial intelligence is infiltrating science is really important and relevant. But it imagines that science is the accumulation of specific facts, that that's a process that can be automated, and that once it's automated, it can just sort of run recursively on itself, right?
Right.
And that's not what science and knowledge are, right? Knowledge doesn't exist without knowers. And science doesn't happen without community and communication and sort of contesting ideas and things like that. And we will sometimes see with these systems the companies bragging about how they did with math problems or coding or things like that. And there's a lot of resources that have been put into making the coding assistants effective at coding. And it's not that they are just general systems that happen to be good at coding. There's a lot of specific training data that's in there that makes it possible to go from buggy code to less buggy code, or an English description to code in some specific programming language. But there's this rhetoric around the idea that computer scientists are really, really smart. So if you have a system that can do things like coding, it is near the apex of what it is to be smart. And clearly, it's about to do the next thing, which is, you know, discover something new. But that's not how science works. And the people who are making those claims are not people who have studied the science of science, for example. They really don't know what they're talking about, but they are selling this technology. And it's a great kind of marketing hype to say, you know, it's going to combust into, if not consciousness, then the ability to do science, and then it's going to recursively do its own science, and we can't keep up. And if we're lucky, it's going to solve all our problems. And if we're unlucky, it's going to kill us all.
Well, I can already tell you as well that that's not how software development works. But yeah. And again, it's very frustrating to have colleagues generate code only to discover that, in fact, it's full of bugs, or that maybe it isn't even full of bugs today, but in a month's time, we discover that it's interacting in a way that actually we would have known if we'd have thought about it. But because someone put that thing together without thinking about it, then it became a problem later on. And now, don't send AI in to fix bugs, please.
No, I'm with you there. It's just a road to technical debt.
Yeah, it's a road to unreliability as well.
Yeah.
And we're seeing that in a lot of technology platforms these days who have adopted it pretty hard, you know, Microsoft platforms and Amazon platforms.
So we said at the top, we wanted to talk about rhetorical technology. And one thing that strikes me about this is like, okay, there's a pile of, as you called it, racist linear algebra, which is fantastic.
I love that. Yeah.
There is some technology there. And I mean, it is fairly impressive as a technology, what it can actually do, you know, the way that it works, it's complex, whatever. But it almost seems like it kind of doesn't matter. It could have been anything. It could have been, for example, cryptocurrency, right? Could have been that. But there is this huge rhetorical mass around it that is even more important than the technology and is trying to get at certain aims. And, you know, we've talked about some of those today. We've talked about them previously in the show, and they're pretty effective. And I have a case in point here, actually. So when we put together the outline for this, I added a few questions on at the end. And you, let's say, pushed back a little bit against the framing of those questions. And I kind of thought about it, and I was like, oh, I fell for the thing that we've been talking about not to do. So like, it is some powerful stuff. So I'm just going to read the questions as I wrote them and let you tell us why those are the wrong questions. So what I asked is that one of the questions we're trying to answer in this season is any of this technology redeemable? So if we focus in on language models for a second, do you think they're useful for anything that's not harmful? So that was the first question. And the second question was, assuming language models aren't useful, are neural networks themselves the original sin? Is there any hope for symbolic AI?
Yeah.
So those were my questions. Let me have right. it.
So the objections come from a couple of places. And I'm going to start with the second one, actually, which is just me personally, I have no interest in the project of building artificial intelligence. And so people will sometimes ask, well, your question there, is there any hope for symbolic AI? I don't care. Right, I don't have the goal of building an artificial thinking machine. I work in computational linguistics. I am very interested in language technology. I think making better automatic transcription is valuable. Also, being careful about how we use it is important. So, for example, we should never say automatic transcripts are good enough for deaf people, for example, especially deaf people who prefer assigned language interpretation. So that is like there's none of this is ever going to be a complete solution, but we can do better language technology. And while it's true that somebody who had the goal of building artificial intelligence, whatever that means, would need to build in language technology, it doesn't follow that language technology exists in the service of artificial intelligence. So that's one set of objections. And then the other one to...
So maybe, sorry, if I can just pause you there for a second. I think it would be really interesting for you to explain when you say you're not interested in the project of artificial intelligence. Like, can you really like lay out what that project is? Like, what do you understand the project to be?
It could be many different things, but in general, I think it lands on machines that can do our thinking for us, or machines that we can interact with as if they were a similar entity to us. I'm not motivated by that goal. And I am upset whenever people suggest that my field exists only in service of that goal. So a couple of years ago, when I was president of the Association for Computational Linguistics, I used my presidential address to give a talk called "The ACL is Not an AI Conference." And that's available for the video if people want to see it. I still need to turn it into a paper. But basically, there are reasons to do language technology that are just completely independent of, on the one hand, this idea of building a machine, building something like Data in Star Trek, for example. Right. Or on the other hand, proving how good the various machine learning algorithms are. That's also not something I care about, right? I'm interested in the language technology as language technology. And then your other question was, is this redeemable? And that's the second time this week I've heard redeem or redemption in this context. And it's an interesting, I think, anthropomorphizing word, because what gets redeemed is souls, right? And we can think about all of the resources and work and effort that's gone into this technology. Is there something worthwhile there? And again, the reason I push back a little bit on that is it feels like whenever we have a conversation about this, we are forced to hold space for, but maybe it's good.
Right.
And right. I want to sort of say we don't actually have to hold space for that. The sort of most skilled person I've ever known at just insisting on, no, I'm just going to say it's bad, is I think she goes as a philosopher, Anna Lauren Hoffman at UW. She's fantastic about like, we can just hate. It's okay. Anthony Moser's good that way too. To answer the question though, I see no beneficial use cases of synthetic text. The killer app for synthetic text is fraud, right? You want to mimic the way people use language? You are building something for fraud, and that's it. Language models are older technology than that. Models of the distribution of word forms in text, very useful component in machine translation, in spell checkers, in autocorrect, and automatic transcription. So if you're using them not in the synthetic text extruding mode, but if you've got some process that's like, well, here's a few different possible strings of words that might have been, rank these according to likelihood, yes, there's beneficial use cases there. And the transformer architecture made those language models better than what we had previously.
Right. I think that's a really sharp point to put on it, actually, that and that's something like, I guess we've been dancing around it, but it's good to say, or not today, sorry, I guess Ray and I have been dancing around it for like 2 years as we talk through this stuff. But I think we've kind of landed on generative uses of this technology are like bad. Like, <Yeah. laughs> we don't want this. But I think the way you said it is much better. There is no useful application of synthetic text. So I will, I'll take that one to the bank. When we ask the question that way, we kind of open the door for this idea that yes, of course, there must be useful uses of this stuff.
Yeah.
So yes, thanks for setting me straight there. Before we wrap up, I'm just wondering, do you have any kind of closing thoughts you'd like to leave us with?
I think one thing that relates to what we've been talking about is the catchphrase, have pride in your own expertise. So one of the problems with the current large language models that are trained on just enormous amounts of data is that we now have systems that can mimic the way we use language in many different contexts. And in doing that mimicking, it looks like we have something that could be a tutor, could be a doctor, could be a lawyer, could be a therapist, and so on. And somehow people seem very susceptible to the argument that it is that, even though if we stop and think about it, we know that when we are teaching, when we're doing software engineering, when we are doing medical or legal practice, the work isn't just the words that we say. It's in the relationships, in the thinking, it's in the connections that we make, it's in the planning, it's in understanding how what we're doing now fits into something later, and so on. And it's in really the communities that happen around these things. And to allow the tech companies to say that their machines for mimicking the language we use in those contexts are as good as we are or better is really to undermine ourselves. And so I think the first lesson is have pride in our own expertise. And then the second one is value the person-to-person connections that you have access to and that you can build.
I think that's great. I mean, trying to understand what makes things successful, not being simply just the words, I think that's a killer point, actually.
And one that I'm surprised at how many times I have to say it.
Well, thank you for joining us and saying it yet again. And we'll certainly join you in repeating it to our friends, families, etc.
Appreciate that. And I appreciate this chance to talk with you and to your audience.
Thanks very much. This is that bit at the end where we thank you for listening to this episode of Polytechs. First, we hope you enjoyed the show, and we really appreciate the time you have given to this subject. If you want to follow up with us, please send email to podcast@polytechs.dev, because that's very direct and doesn't have any algorithms. If you prefer social media, we're at Polytechs on Blue Sky and at Polytechs at mastodon.social. We're not on Twitter for obvious reasons. To help the show reach a wider audience, please share it with your friends, family, and colleagues. There's nothing as good as a real human recommendation. You can find out more about the show on the website, which is polytechs.dev. As you should expect, there are no cookies or tracking of any kind. All the show notes, transcripts, and contact details are over there. If you want to show a deeper level of commitment, there's also an option to donate. We're passionate about free and open access to the episodes, so there's no obligation and there are no benefits other than a warm feeling in your heart. Finally, we would really appreciate a 5-star review on your podcast platform. Reading positive reviews makes us feel good and can help others find the show and make them feel like it's worth their time. Okay, that's all the admin done, and we hope to see you next week. Bye!